From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. We're living in a time where wildfires in Oregon are no longer just a threat to our beautiful wilderness areas. We're also living in a time where these wildfires are no longer just a threat to tiny rural communities. Recently, Sisters, Oregon faced such a threat. Now, no one is going to confuse Sisters with a metropolis, but make no mistake, the recent fires there posed a true and dangerous risk to thousands of people living in that area. Today on the show, you'll hear from someone who witnessed it all and chronicled the scene for his community, the editor-in-chief of the Nugget newspaper right there in Sisters. Then, at the end of the show, we'll check in with our reporter about a quirky event in Corvallis that's part race and part art exhibit. That's next on Oregon on the Record. Sisters, Oregon is a great town. It has a wonderful main street, a vibrant art scene, and is surrounded by natural beauty. And just last week, it was also surrounded by a harrowing wildfire. And right there in the town, the editor-in-chief of the town's long-serving newspaper was able to witness and write about the ordeal. We check in with him now to get a sense of what it's been like living in the eye of the firestorm. Jim Cornelius, editor-in-chief of the Nugget newspaper and Sisters. Jim, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us.
My pleasure.
Great. So, gosh, why don't you just give us a general overview of the situation in Sisters right now?
Right now, we're on a glide path to being done with the immediate impacts of the Akala Butte fire. Situation is well in hand, and it's actually a bluebird day in Sisters. It's beautiful. There's no smoke, and conditions are very greatly improved from where they were a week ago.
Yeah. How bad was it? How bad was the air quality and just the level of smoke around Sisters just even a few days ago?
We've seen worse air quality due to the prevailing winds. We were not as negatively impacted by smoke with this fire as we were with last year's flat fire, and as we have been with other fires, even that were not in the immediate area. The threat and the impact of this fire was less in terms of smoke impacts as it was a direct threat to the community.
Okay. How close did the fire come to, you know, the central part of town?
The fire never got closer than about 5 miles from town, maybe a little less than that. But last Wednesday, the 22nd, in the afternoon, the fire was moving so fast, the intensity of the fire was so great, and it was so erratic that the possibility that it would make it all the way to town was a very real one. And this is the first time in my memory that we have had actual evacuation level one notices in town, which was startling to a lot of the community. We felt vulnerable in Sisters proper in a way that we have not in past fires. So Wednesday was, as the firefighters described it, fast and furious, and it was really touch and go there for a while. Okay. And the subdivisions to the north of us were under very acute threat.
Okay. What kind of damage are we talking about with regard to acreage or any structures that were burned? Can you give us sort of an encapsulate sort of between Wednesday and now, what kind of damage that this fire caused?
There are two confirmed losses of homes in the Stevens Canyon area to the north of us. The fire is a little over 27,000 acres. Our reporters that were out on the line on Friday came back with footage that indicates that, you know, some of the areas were very severely burned, others less so, which is normal in wildfires. But on Wednesday, the fire posed a really significant threat to the homes along Wilt Road and Indian Ford Road here in Sisters. And actually I had friends that were out on Indian Ford Road that were not at all confident that their houses would survive, but they did.
Oh, that's great to hear. Obviously, a lot of us who live on the western side of the Cascades, we're very familiar with the central district of Sisters, but kind of contextualize for us, you know, how far flung are residents and, you know, maybe pull the string a little bit more about which areas of town were, boy, just really in the teeth of this fire.
Well, the fire was coming from the north of us and the northeast. Mm-hmm. There are a number of rural residential subdivisions to the north of us. I couldn't give you a number on the residences, but there's thousands of them.
Okay.
And many there are some houses that are just out in the forest, mm-hmm. but mainly these are rural subdivisions with, you know, acre, 2 acre lots, some smaller than that. All the way out Wilt Road, Whiteches Canyon Estates is out there on Wilt Road. They were under immediate threat from the flat fire last year.
Wow.
So there's a lot of folks that live out there to the north, and they were under threat 2 years in a row, and very significant threat.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the mood in the town, both what it felt like you described, where it was really touch and go on Wednesday, to now, you know, kind of where it seems like things are better.
On Wednesday the 22nd, the word I kept hearing from everyone, and it was the word that I would use to characterize the circumstances, was apocalyptic. Hmm. It was extremely dark. The smoke cloud from the fire, there was a pyrocumulus cloud from the fire, so that was creating its own weather. You could see lightning in the smoke column.
Wow.
A thunderstorm was coming in, so you had that kind of charged feeling in the air. And the fire was really on the march. I mean, there was no fighting that fire. They had to pull crews away from it for their own safety. And from about 3:30 till probably about 6 or 6:30, it really felt apocalyptic, and that's the word that many people use. The incident commander referred to it as you know, Armageddon stuff, and that's the way it felt. The rain that we got from that thunderstorm and the winds out of the south were, that felt providential. Hmm. I mean, we felt like we had really, really dodged a bullet there, and it went from that feeling of doom to, I think we're going to make it. And then Thursday, you know, we had 2 days of hot temperatures, pretty stiff winds, but it wasn't blowing the fire directly at Sisters anymore, and people started to feel like we were getting ahead of the crisis point, or getting past the crisis point is probably a better way to put it. By the weekend, you know, we were all feeling pretty good, and just a lot of relief. But there's a lot of fatigue, too, because this keeps happening.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jim Cornelius. He's the editor-in-chief of the Nugget newspaper and Sisters. Have you spoken to folks that maybe had to leave their homes for under evacuation orders? You know, if you did, what'd they say? And hopefully they were able to return now and see that their houses weren't destroyed. Have you had a chance to talk to folks like that?
Oh, yes. You know, on a professional basis, we've talked to evacuees, but as I mentioned earlier, I have friends who were evacuated, a number of them. And some of them, this is the second year in a row that they've been evacuated and weren't sure that they were going to come home to a standing house. So, you know, they were brave about it. There was a level of resignation, especially on that Wednesday when it looked pretty bad. Hopeful. They certainly put a lot of trust in the firefighting effort, because last year in the flat fire, the structure protection units really did heroic work in saving homes. So there was a high level of confidence in the firefighters. So, it was a mixture of resignation and hopefulness, which is kind of odd, but that's the nature of it. But yeah, they're all back now, certainly feeling relieved. But like I said, there's a tremendous amount of fatigue from living like this.
Yeah. Know? Well, and we're still in July, you know, and maybe even if you could, I mean, not only fatigue, but is there anxiousness about, okay, we still have August and September to go through?
I think people are enjoying feeling a little sense of relief. And like I said, today is just a beautiful day. And there seems to be sort of a relaxation of that level of tension that people were carrying for the better part of 2 weeks. But yeah, there's nobody that's not aware that there's still a lot of fire out there. There's fires to the north of us on Warm Springs that, you know, bear paying attention to. Mm-hmm. And of course, the fires off to the east of us, yesterday, the plume from the Brewer fire was clearly visible from Sisters. So, you know, we're all aware that, we could be back in the bucket again, you know, another thunderstorm or something going sideways with any of the multitude of fires to the north of us. So, you know, it's a wary optimism, kind of a deep breath, but yeah, nobody's taking for granted that that we're done with this.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask you personally, you know, and you described that how you had friends who had to be evacuated. Talk about how it is that, talk about the challenge of being both a chronicler of what's going on, being the editor-in-chief of the newspaper, but also, I imagine, concern for your own safety, your house, your reporters who are out there. Maybe talk a little bit about having to sort of have, you know, both feet in sort of both, I've got a job to do to tell this story, but I've also got a town I'm very concerned about.
Yeah, you know, I see my role in terms of my own family, friends, and the staff at the newspaper of, you know, being a calm leader, mm-hmm. and not, you know, not stoking up any sort of panic. We just had a plan. We've had a plan, as everyone who lives here should, for what we would do, you know, where my family would evacuate to and where we would go if we had to evacuate the newspaper and how we would put out a newspaper under those conditions. And you just kind of have to just maintain an even string and kind of work the problem methodically. I've been doing this for so long that the roles kind of blend together. Just on a personal level, it's good to have a job to do. I'd rather have a job to do than to just sit and wait and watch. You know, it does have value. I know that it does have value keeping the community informed, and that's a partnership with a whole bunch of people now. There's a lot of information available to people now. It's always chaotic in the first days of and up to the crisis point in a fire. So making sure that you are providing timely and accurate information is important for everyone. And that's what we try to do, and it's gratifying that helps people, and it's better, like I said, than just wait and watch.
Yeah, Jim, that actually led to my last question, which you pretty much answered, but I just again, you know, obviously with the state of journalism, a lot of small papers are closing. You know, yeah, talk about that importance of having, you know, somebody who lives in the community and has ownership of the paper to be able to give the people real-time important local information.
Well, there's a, you know, a level of trust that's been built up over many, many, many years with the community, that's not something that we take lightly. And, you know, it's changed over the years. Most of our fire coverage was on Facebook, frankly, and, you know, just pushing out information as quickly as we got it, because that's where most people were looking for the information. Our print edition this week is more of a chronicle of a community under threat. A variety of feature articles that sort of explain how things worked in the fire, which I think is of interest to people. But we're not breaking news with the weekly newspaper by any stretch of the imagination. So you have to kind of toggle between being a real-time information provider and then a chronicler of the life of the community. And I think we did a good job of both of those things.
He is the editor-in-chief of the Nugget Newspaper and Sisters, Jim Cornelius. Jim, thank you so much for taking time out to talk with us.
Thanks for reaching out. Appreciate it.
Let's check in with our Macy Moore about their story of a very quirky race in Corvallis. Macy Moore, reporter for us here at KLCC. Macy, glad to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Tell folks, I love this story, and you also captured some great photos, and we'll link to that in the show, but tell us about the Grand Kinetic Challenge.
Yeah, so the Grand Kinetic Challenge is a kinetic sculpture race that takes place in Corvallis every third weekend of July. Mm-hmm. A kinetic sculpture in the racing context, because like a kinetic sculpture you might generally say is just something that, a sculpture that moves.
Okay.
In the racing context, they're more kind of like bicycles typically, and they're vehicles, but they also have art on them. So
okay.
Like the race director described them to me as like hybrid bicycles with New Orleans style floats on top. And I think that's like a perfect way to encapsulate them, because they can be sort of hard to describe.
So it begs the question, is it an art exhibit that also involves racing, or is it a race that also involves art?
It's a race that also involves art.
Okay.
I think the racing is key. It's what makes it stick out as something more than like a typical weird art exhibit you would go see.
Okay. Are there like heats? Are there like age groups? How is it sort of put together as a race?
It's all time-based, and so kind of like at other types of motorsports racing where there's like pilots or drivers and a pit crew, and then if you have to make repairs or they like go in the river for part of this race, so they have to like get them ready to go in the river, that's all a part of your time. And then the people with the best time who meet all of the other qualifiers. So it's like a non-motorized vehicle. They're typically pedaled. You have to pack everything with you. There's a bunch of different qualifiers. So it's time plus meeting those qualifiers is how you win.
And then so like roughly how long is the race?
Well, it's 2 days.
Okay.
The exact time length for how long it'll take kind of depends a lot by the size of your vehicle and if you've done it before.
Okay.
And it's split into 4 major challenges. So there's like a road race where they like drive around Corvallis, and then they go to the fairgrounds and they go up a big sand dune. And then they go to Crystal Lake Sports Park on the second day and go through a really deep bog of mud. And then they float down the Willamette River.
Wow. And so, you know, describe as best you can, what are these things kind of, I mean, we have photos, but describe, use your storytelling skills that you've been developing. Tell us what they kind of look like.
So they look like all sorts of different things, but I would definitely start with a bicycle because most of them are bike-based. Often people who build these have like some sort of bicycle knowledge. And then so some of them, like the one that comes from Philomath, looks like a big bus that has like an inside that's all seats with a bunch of bicycles and a bunch of people pedal and then one person steers.
Wow.
There was another one that's like 2 bikes hooked together and it has like a banana on top and bread loaves on the sides, like sculpture.
Okay.
There's one that looks like a spaceship where there's like bikes inside and then they build a big spaceship around it with a rabbit in the spaceship.
Huh. Is there a limit to how many people powering these vehicles can be? I mean, are there different categories, like 1 person, 10 people?
Not really.
Okay.
Like, it's competitive.
Okay.
But it's not like So competitive. Like, it's definitely more about the community and having fun.
Okay.
And there's so many different ways that you can win awards. Like, you can win awards for being the most visual or the most innovative. Or sometimes if the judges, like, there's one award that's like, the judges just really like you and think you're cool. Like, you get an award. Or there's a best stuffed animal award. So every vehicle will have a stuffed animal on it, and whichever one like matches the vibe of the vehicle and the theme of the race for the year, the best will like win the best stuffed animal award. So it's competitive, but not, that's not okay. really the point.
Okay. Describe kind of what the crowd was like. I mean, how many people were there showing up? Was it a big deal?
It was a big deal. Mm. It was a pretty big event, especially the first day where the race started. But even like out at the Mud Bog, which was the second spot I went to watch, there was like a ton of people all lined up in their own chairs on the sides, like cheering for teams. All the teams have trading cards they'll give you and other little trinkets. Like, there was a hot dog themed vehicle that was giving out like hot dog whistles.
Okay.
So like, I think people get really into it to go and like get the little trinkets and root for their favorite team. There's several local teams, so you can like root for people you know.
Okay.
Theoretically.
As you were watching, was there a particular vehicle that you were impressed just that it could move and actually race? And then corresponding, the other question is, was there a vehicle that you looked at in terms of its artistic value where you're like, wow, that is visually stunning?
Ooh. The big vehicle from Philomath, that's the big bus, is very impressive because it is huge. Mm-hmm. So like it's piloted by like 8 people.
Wow.
And if your vehicle's heavy enough, you can get extra time taken off of your time score. So they had like one girl sitting in the back who just pushed them over the weight limit so they could get the time buffer, because they're really big and massive and very slow.
Hmm.
And then for artistic ability, I really liked a California team that had their vehicle as a big tiger.
Hmm.
And every year it's a tiger, but it's like a different themed tiger. So this year it was Abracatiger, and it was like a magical themed tiger.
Well, so that begs the question. You said it's from California. So this isn't just people from the surrounding area, right?
This is a major race circuit. So this is the Grand Connect Challenge is a part of the West Coast Circuit. I think there's 4 to 6 races in the West Coast Circuit.
Okay.
But you can race across the country on the East Coast. There's like a national race. It's a big community.
Fun story. Macy, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us.
Yeah, thank you.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Monday on the show, the most prosperous and wealthy companies in Oregon also have the most employees needing to use Medicaid instead of employer-provided health care. We talked to a reporter who dug into the numbers to learn about this shocking disparity. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.